This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook, where I give you access each week to the world's greatest athletes and executives about their personal and professional playbook and what has made them champions on and off the field.
Yankees win!
That contract extension was for $176 million.
Touchdown! And a title for the Patriots!
I can't believe it!
I'm your host and CEO of Sports One Marketing, David Meltzer. This is Dave Meltzer, CEO of Sports One Marketing, here with a live playbook for Entrepreneur. And I am here for a second time with one of my favorite guests that never got publicized, Paul Rabil, the world's greatest lacrosse player.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Excited to be here. I just landed and hopped in a Lyft. Dropped my bags off at the Hilton, walked over here, ready to go.
That's awesome. This is one of the first cities that I didn't Uber or Lyft because we had so many bags. I was like, let's rent a car so we could have mobile storage and then Uber in from where we parked.
Renting cars is a win from my perspective, especially when you have a lot of bags. We run one of our businesses is lacrosse camps and clinics, and we stay in major market cities. We travel to 14 a year, and we'll get these SUVs. And there's still something about the on-demand driving experience of just being able to get in your car, drive it, not have to worry about Uber, Lyft, the transactions, the late fees, all that stuff.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because what makes you unique, you know, I ran a big sports agency, so I've dealt with a lot of athletes before, and I've always said there's something extraordinary about the world's best. No matter what you're playing or doing, there's a different vibration to being the world's best. But what makes you really unique is this is, to me, about compassionate capitalism. You know, I wrote a book about three things. It's how to make money, help people, and have fun. And when I look at your book of work so far, the thing that makes you different than most athletes is you have a keen understanding of how to monetize things for the right purpose.
Mm-hmm.
When and where did that start?
Well, I would agree. I think that journey that you wrote about and you described there in making money, helping people, having fun. For me, it's kind of inside out model. I really enjoy and derive a lot of energy from helping, generally just working with people. I get equally in probably more cases, more value than in interacting with people than perhaps I think I'm giving off. So that is always like strategy number one for me. And then I think in a certain case, when we're playing sports, we're doing that. Having fun is a part of that. That's part of that experience. And then if you're lucky enough, you can monetize. And I think the game that I'm playing now is monetization in the long run, because I'm in the media game and you have to go after total eyeballs, ears. In this case, we're in person, hand to hand. But if you can create a good product, a great service, tell a wonderful story about it, word of mouth is still the most powerful form of marketing out there. It converts far higher than any other paid advertising or direct mail, which is probably second. And both of those feel more archaic based on the society we live in today. But if you can have that impact on someone in person, it's more fruitful for personal development, and it tends to be the fastest way to grow any business or strategy, product, or service.
So it's interesting because you talk about what I call shifting the paradigm of value. And I think it's remarkable that a lot of people that do make a lot of money, they've detached from that outcome. They actually are trying to provide value. So for instance, for me, I made money the first round and lost it all. And the second time around, I said, you know what? What if I woke up every morning and said to God, can you please put 10 people in front of me I can help? And then I did everything in my power all day to provide value to not only those 10 people, but, and it doesn't mean I'm sitting at home high on my mom's couch, dreaming, you know, some or handing out in the streets of Calcutta everything I own. I'm very driven the same way you are in all the things that you did, but I truly have shifted the paradigm of value. And I haven't heard someone organically explain that, hey, I'm just here trying to provide value. Do you have to have a trust in the universe that this stuff's going to come back? Because there is a directive of making money from what you're doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. You have to have some level of trust. You have to know that opportunity awaits. Not sure when it's going to come, but it will. And when it does, you have to be fully prepared and ready to jump. For me, I call myself an entrepreneur by necessity. A lot of entrepreneurs, those in the room here and yourself, will also acknowledge that it's kind of you're born with it. A lot of it is innate, and that hustle, that curiosity, that willingness to think at a macro level, roll your sleeves up, and operate in the micro trenches. In lacrosse, very different than, say, just the big four sports, our wages are minuscule compared to them. So we play professionally as a passion. When I graduated from Johns Hopkins, I took a job as an analyst for an investment sales real estate team in D.C. to try and create additional income. I was fortunate because I learned a little bit about how to chop up through Excel sheets and value businesses. But that lasted 9 months. I was playing on a parallel kind of weekend to the regular work week. I got an endorsement with Under Armour, small cash at the time, and an opportunity to be a part of some of their national marketing campaigns. Then I started getting inbound emails from local youth lacrosse operators who wanted me to make appearances there. I started thinking about, well, why don't I just own my own youth lacrosse business and provide a ton of value directly to the homes? So I met with my real estate brokers, decided to leave, became one of the first full-time professional lacrosse players. I threw that in air quotes for those that are listening to this back. And just began to kind of create my own path. And the necessity part was, okay, I'm here now. What are the tools at my disposal? That was in 2008 when I graduated. Facebook had just launched their business and fan pages. It was pre-Twitter, pre-Instagram, Snapchat. And I was like, okay, I know I have, at the time, if you remember the cap, and it still may be the case with Facebook, is 5,000 friends. So I had a bunch of young lacrosse players who were watching me on ESPN with Johns Hopkins, and I would always accept them, and I was capped. So I had about 10,000 friends pending. Then when Facebook launched their fan page, I opened that, and that was limitless. So I started building a rapport with the young lacrosse player using new media, is what we call it, versus traditional media or linear media, who, again, is focused on telling the story of the big four sports. So for the first time in 2008, because of social media, we were able to have a conversation as professional lacrosse players with young lacrosse players, tell our story, and then figure out how to monetize. And I think, again, that word monetization really comes as kind of a tailwind of doing something really impactful.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I get a lot of young entrepreneurs, since that's the way my brand has rolled out, that they don't know when to go all in, right? Yeah. And it's worse for middle-aged entrepreneurs, because I hear it all the time. You know, I have this dream. I really want to do what you do, Mr. Meltzer. I want to work in sports, but I'm a real estate guy. I'm a financial planner. I'm this, and I hate it every day. But I have a family. I have a mortgage. I make really good money. And it's, for the last few years, I've been trying to do this. What I find, you got to be all in.
Yep.
What advice would you give to a 35-year-old lacrosse player that wants to follow his dream of working in the business of lacrosse, not playing lacrosse, but, you know, monetizing some sort of solution that he has, but he has a family, a house, and a life?
Right.
How should he deal with that?
Yeah. So I think there are two things that have really stuck with me. The first came from one of my previous podcast guests, was John Brankus, and he said it kind of in passing. So he's a sports science guy, and he's met with a lot of athletes like you have and has built a business off of it. And a lot of people tell their younger daughter or son, hey, do whatever you want in life. And he says, be a little bit more pragmatic, and the thing should be, do whatever you can in life. And for the 35-year-old or the 45-year-old person who's interested in getting in lacrosse, probably at that point, it's not playing professionally if they hadn't to that point. So it's having that pragmatic approach that doing whatever I can probably pushes them away from playing on field. At this moment, there's other opportunities which I'll talk to. The other thing is Ben Horowitz said this in his graduation speech at GSB, which we hear often, follow your passion in life. And he said, don't follow your passion. Very rarely does your passion align with your skill set. And if it does, great, you can be a unicorn and you may be romanticized as overnight success. Many people know that, you know, the overnight successes 15, 20 years to get there. That said, he said, follow what you're really, really good at. So find what you're talented at And if it's accounting and you're going to be a CPA and start your own practice and then become very talented at that, get a ton of inbound clientele, it's like what gets really good is when you become very good at what your skills are, the accoutrements in life and the first class round trip airfare and the opportunity to speak at the national convention for CPAs, that's what brings a lot of the fulfillment and fun. That lifestyle kicks in, and before you know it, that skill set becomes your passion. So it's kind of re-engineering the way we're thinking about, like, oh, you know, I love film and I want to be an actor or actress, but maybe that's not just within my skill set. What am I really good at? Let me pursue that hard. You're on a much faster track to success. And then when you get really good at that, life is going to become great.
It's a great point. A lot of people ask me, how do you get a job in sports? And I go, there are no sports jobs. You can't just say I'm a sports guy, right? There's skills and there's knowledge. Mm-hmm. Most people have the desire to do what they love to do. Music, art, sports. 80% of the people in America love sports. It's proven. So 80% of the people in America want a job in sports because they love some sport. But they forget that it's the skill part, you know, as Paul says. And I think they also have to look at the knowledge. You know, you can have all the skill in the world, but if you're not asking for help and having mentorship from the people that are in the situation that you want to be in. And so many people, you know, I teach this whole thing about ask and attract. And the most successful people are not afraid to ask. And when I lost everything, the reason I lost everything is my ego was in my own way. I was afraid to ask anyone for help. Mm-hmm. I owned a golf course, never asked one person that owned a golf course, hey, what should I do? Because I knew it. Do you still ask for help?
All the time. I say that most of, if not all of what I share with other people has been gleaned from my mentors, people that I read about, folks that I listen to over audio or read about in their biographies or autobiographies. So I think I'm very honest and open when it comes to that. I don't consider myself an inventor. I consider myself more of a chemist. So taking what's out there and try to make a concoction of what makes sense for me. So I think that's really important. And then, you know, to your point around work ethic and that grind, especially as a young analyst or someone trying to get into sports for the first time. What I've found more than anything else, and I'm continually upstarting new projects from scratch or investing in early stage startups or building a new form of content on a new medium like a podcast, is that those with endurance are the ones that ultimately reach a level of success. You can work really hard, and I see it in sports, especially with athletes. We're seeing athletes start podcasts and YouTube channels and all this stuff. And they get in, and it's fun, but then once you're in, and you're expected to perform on a cadence that's weekly, in some cases daily, it actually gets really hard. And you have to put your head down, and we find that those who embrace the level of endurance that it requires in any business to be successful are the ones that win. Seth Rogen talked about it in acting. We've heard it, I heard it, I explored it at some point. It's like people go out to LA and they say, I'm gonna give this a shot, and then when I turn 30, I'm gonna turn around because I'll just, you know, I've been out there for 8 years, it didn't work. And he says, if you look at all the successful actors and actresses, they hit it when they turn 33. And so it's like people are turning over at 30, and if they just stuck it out for a few more years, but we create these paths that often fail us in our own way.
Yeah, there's this consistent, which means every day, persistent, which means never quit, enjoyment of the pursuit of our potential. And I see that as a common characteristic, people like you that are just successful. I heard an analogy, and I want to see how it applies to your life. There's this certain tree that it doesn't grow for 4 years, and it appears not to grow, but what's happening is actually all these roots are growing, and it establishes an extraordinary root system, and then actually can grow 80 feet in the fifth year. And I see a lot of entrepreneurs, athletes, actresses, people that are following their passion, they don't realize the unraveling of their own root system, and they give up right when they're about to shoot up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We were just talking before we started. You know, I already kind of categorized lacrosse as a smaller sport, and I'm constantly trying to network with the major platforms that have all the eyeballs. You know, the Facebooks, which house Instagram, the Googles and YouTubes, the Amazons, the Twitters of the world. And every year I go out to Silicon Valley and I meet with their sports partnership teams and I basically say, hey, how can I be better? How can I work with some of your new tools and gadgets? And we've had these conversations year over year over year. I've been playing professionally for 10 years. All the time I've been spending with Instagram, just visiting campus, introducing myself, saying hello, they finally came back to me about 2 weeks ago. Lacrosse season is here, it's spring. And they go, hey, we want to do an Instagram story on lacrosse. Would you like to shoot it and it'll live on our account? I go, absolutely. They have 233 million followers. Give you guys an idea, Netflix, which has now taken over broadband cable, is around 110 million subs. Cable has gone from like 90, 95 million households down to the low 80 million. And that's like total reach. So I realize with Instagram, I'm not hitting 233 million people at once. They have that organic reach algorithm. But nevertheless, it's the biggest platform lacrosse has ever been on. And they just posted it today. So I'm here and like putting shoulder content out to support it and try and make sense of that story. But that's an example of exactly what you're talking about, which is I was just meeting with them, never asking for anything, never expecting anything. I was investing in those relationships, those commonalities that we shared. In this case, it was content and tech. So I think that's important. When you sit down with mentors, or if you try to build a mentorship, don't ask for stupid shit. I think that's really important. A lot of people just like, you know, will ask me that are coming to try and figure out a way into lacrosse, some stuff that they could probably just type into Google. And that can perturb a lot of the leadership that you're looking to form a relationship with. So be really thoughtful, have good questions to ask, certainly have tough enough skin to realize that like your first two, three, maybe four meetings might get canceled because that person's really busy. So put your ego aside and realize like, hey, this is okay. I've had to do that. I've traveled to Boston and New York and out west and had the meeting canceled. Flew on my own dime, swallowed the ego, went back, wrote a nice follow-up email. That built the relationship even stronger.
Yeah, and I think another piece of advice that I have, because we get a lot of people that make those requests of us, number one, be concise and prepared, but two, make sure that you have what it takes to follow up. So one of the tricks that I've learned, because I'm building a brand known for getting back to people quickly, right? I'll email them, DM them, and I shock people. When I have trolls, I'll tell them to call me on my cell phone because I really want to learn. I do. I'm like, hey, I want to learn. And it's all of a sudden they're explaining themselves away. But when they make an ask, I always make an ask back. So it could be something as simple as, look, I'll do that for you, but send me a paperclip. And it's amazing. 99% of the people, they'll go way out of their way to all this stuff, but will never send me the paperclip. You know, and by doing that, there needs to be an exchange. You have to be completely committed. And anybody will answer you if you're concise and strategic about what you're asking for. If they're capable, I always use this example. If somebody asks you something you're capable of doing, why won't you do it? Truly, people love to give. I ask crowds, who here loves to give? Everyone raises their hand immediately. But if you ask people who here likes to receive, there's a hesitation. Yep. And some people won't even raise their hand because you have to suck up your ego to receive. Where does your ego play a role in? Because lacrosse, alternative sport, yep. And you know, I'm sure a lot of people, you walk in like me, and they'll say, well, I didn't even know who Paul Rabil was.
Right.
But yet there's millions of people at your frequency that will drive all the way back from San Antonio when they hear you're here. But there's the majority of the 3.2 billion people on the internet that don't know who the hell you are.
Yep.
How do you deal with that ego-wise?
So I used to have a pretty big ego, and I think all of that stuff would give me a quick jolt, but because I knew how important, and I had a little bit of realistic state in my mindset to be here right now with you and push this message. It'll
lower his ego a lot. Sorry, we don't like to interject on the... That I would, to come here with me, all right. See how humble he is?
That I would get over that ego. Nevertheless, it used to still really crawl and bother me. I've spent a lot of time in personal therapy. It's been really valuable for me. What got me in there originally was something that I thought was catastrophic and learned that it was not at all. So I played for Team USA and we lost our world championships to Canada back in 2014. Like many athletes, I was kind of so confined and kind of married to the sport. It's all that mattered. My identity was in the sport. It was who I was, not what I did. And that loss, and we all kind of like smirk, and I can laugh at it now.
Except for the Canadian in the back.
Well, despite the lacrosse people that may be listening, like, because they'll still say, like, come on, Paul, that's a big loss. We're better than the Canadians in lacrosse. You shouldn't have lost second. So, like, I understand and respect the mindset of a traditional athlete, like, losing at that stage is not okay. Nevertheless, I was depressed, and I was ruining my friendships and my relationships at home. And however it ends up for any of us, starting to dive into deep personal work is, I think, the key that unlocks real fulfillment in our lives. So part of that was probably 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks of figuring out how to deal with something that was sport related. And then it became more about relationships in the locker room, what real leadership is, what caring about people means, developing empathy, and really investing in that. It is certainly a buzzword that we hear a lot, but there hasn't been any other skill that I've learned, physical or mental, that has the power of empathy. Not even close in my life. And you mentioned trolls. We call them trolls. I even like kind of cringe. I don't think there are trolls. Right? Like, people just want to be heard. And everyone, every comment that's out there and every person that reacts a certain way has something to do with the way that they were raised, their peer group, the school system, a lot of which, by the way, they were out of control of. And it's led to that moment, to that thought. And to them, that is their truth. That's the fact. That's the way they're seeing it. And for so long, I tried to get them to rethink or force feed a different thought rather than just saying, like, let me be with you and try to understand that. And there's nothing more powerful that I can do now with the lacrosse community or people that I speak to on my podcast than to actually admit in some cases or in many cases, oh, I was actually wrong there, or thanks for bringing that up. I hadn't thought about that. Or, you know what, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm going to go think about it. Like, just having the humility to say, you know, I don't know everything, and certainly very few people in a general percentage of the world's population know who I am, know what lacrosse is, but that's okay,
right?
And my goal isn't to try and get more people to find out about me. If that comes because of, like, really strong, earnest, authentic, meaningful conversations and partnerships and businesses that we build, then terrific. Because ultimately, just like you, we want to spread goodness, talk about social justices, human interests, why the world is at conflict, why it shouldn't be.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, if you have negative comments in your life, the greatest thing about social media to me is I go to their Facebook page and I see, wow, that's their perception of everything.
Yeah.
Right? They have attacking thoughts. They have a need to be right, a need to be offended. Whatever you've done to them, you can see it through what they're posting, and it's not necessarily you.
Social media is crazy, double-edged sword. I'll just jump in there,
please.
Real quick, which it's been amazing for folks like us who've been able to build a network and an audience and have direct connection with people. But on the flip side, what the algorithms are built to do is create these social bubbles that are really impossible to breach, because we follow people that we think we're a lot alike or that we share certain values with, whether that be political or social. And so you're constantly inundated with the same thought. So former President Barack Obama, 44th president, one of the best presidents ever from my perspective.
Occidental College.
Says that, you know, they ran a study, a third-party study, where you had a conservative, a liberal, and a fairly moderate voting patron type in, I think it was Tel Aviv, into Google. And for each group or for each person, a different search came back, because this engine realized, you know, based on all of their history and their likes and how they block themselves off, what's more likely to be clicked on, right? So I think in a way, that's the bad side of the double-edged sword. And what's great about sports, and I share this with my peers across all different sports who are athletes and even entertainers and entrepreneurs and folks like yourself, is we're actually the few people that cross over these social bubbles. You know, I have conservatives and liberals who follow me, right? And when I post about, you know, International Women's Day, which was last week, and really show my support and advocacy of such, I'll get some folks that come in and say, like, well, what about International Men's Day? And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? You have no idea. It's like, you know, so.
You mean the other 364 days?
So, exactly.
Exactly.
So you know, you're going to face that. And I think it's within our power and part of, again, how I see our place to be is to hopefully use our celebrity in a way to kind of pop those bubbles and share stories.
Yeah, it's remarkable the influence and reach that you can have. It's also scary. So, you know, dealing, I deal with four words all the time. You know, when my love was making money because I grew up so broke and I wasn't a great athlete, although I played football in college, but I wanted to make a lot of money. So when I lost all my money, I think it was like Warren Moon losing, you know, that 32-0 game at halftime. In fact, I used to tell people if I had to sit in public and tell people that, let alone my mom, that I went bankrupt. I mean, I had millions of dollars. I had a golf course, a ski mountain, 33 homes alone in San Diego. I lost them all.
How low were you?
You know, it was interesting. I was low for one day, and my wife pretty much saved my life because she literally came to me and said, look, take stock in who you were and what you want to become. And I get choked up thinking about it. I sat in bed, and I thought to myself, you know what? If I can look up, I can get up. But I spent one day going, how the hell did I lose all my money? Like, I worked so hard, and it was so important to me, and it changed my complete perspective. I shifted this paradigm, and I started being of service. And I outlined my book, Connected to Goodness, which was a roadmap to helping people. And two words, I started with thank you. That's what I put next to my bed, just to remind me, God, I got so much. I write so much. And then it changed to, as everything started swinging back my way, and what sits on my nightstand is radical humility. Because you do, you get all this attention and you want to do the right things, and I'm constantly fighting, I'm not that good. You know, it's exciting and it's fun and people will drive all over to see you, but the truth is, you know, I have these great experiences that I want to share and motivate and inspire people with, but I'm the same as everyone else. And I would just like everyone's life to be a little bit better because I give them a different perspective because I'm radically humble that I was an idiot. I lost everything. I was an asshole. But you know what? I changed. And the universe keeps bringing it back to me.
I really like that radical humility. I've been kicking around radical acceptance, which comes from Stoicism and helps you live in the present moment, which is just acknowledging what's happened, the mishaps that we made, the bad decisions, or the right decisions, and just radically accepting your present moment, what's in it, and then the next thing that you're going to do, not get too high, not to get too low. I think it's stereotyped as unemotional. It's certainly not. I could feel your emotion right there.
Sure.
It was like a really wonderful share, and I could almost like feel that day that you said you were low. Radical acceptance is something that I'm continually trying to improve at. And you can do so through daily meditation, certain tactical calendar settings, shut your device off, put it in airplane mode. We can all get distracted there. But I think step one is awareness of getting caught up in the past or the future. Step two would be the intentional practice of doing something about it.
That's awesome. Last question. What legacy do you want to leave, Paul?
That's a really great question. And the answer is nothing.
Awesome.
So I just did a team exercise with our current USA team. So our world championships are every 4 years. We put an application in to become an Olympic sport in 2016. We're supposed to get recognition this summer. So it'd be as early as 2024, likely 2028 when the games are in LA in the US, just as a side note. So we're in our world championship year. It's gonna be in Israel this summer. There's 50 countries across the world competing. So we had a training camp this past weekend and we brought in JC Glick, who's a former Army Ranger and a great motivational coach and speaker. And he had us write down using visuals, who we are, who we want to be and what we want other people to see us as. And I spent a lot of time in it, and I feel like I had a little bit of a head start because I've been in almost 3 years of therapy. So I've been doing a lot of this on my own. But I think, I'll fast forward. So what people think of us should just, that slate should be wiped clean. And it's not disregarding the importance of other people in our lives. That's important. But what you want to bring them up to is to the first part, which is show them who you actually are, your actual self. So open up, be vulnerable as you were, and say, like, here's everything that I am, all the scars and all the calluses that have built, and in some cases, the successes. So we live in a world where we show our actual self and we have our ideal self. We're always working to become the best version of ourselves. And I think where guilt comes in and sometimes a lot of regret is when either consciously or subconsciously we make decisions in our lives that take us off the track to our ideal self. So we know who it is we want to be. We just have to find that and then figure out through some type of diligence and discipline how to get there. Partnerships, relationally, through friendships, or even your partner at home, are often the best ways to find your ideal self. People help you actualize. And I think that's who we should be looking for in business and relationally to work with, are people that are going to encourage us to be our best version of ourselves. So it's a long way of answering your question. I'm not concerned about legacy. That feels to me like the impact I want, or how I want people to walk away and say, oh, this great lacrosse player, the impact he had. I just want people to know who Paul Rabil is, what he did, the trials and tribulations in his life, the people that he worked with, the people who helped him. And then just say, okay, that in some cases are some areas that I want to follow. In other cases, that kind of that chemist mentality, I'll take a couple of things here and add that to what I'm doing. And then Roger Bannister, who had just passed away this past week, the first person to break the 4-minute mile threshold. I wrote about this in our email newsletter. Shortly after doing that, it had never been done before. Within 10 years, several hundred people had broken the 4-minute mile. And exactly 10 years later, a high schooler did. I once had the fastest shot in lacrosse. 1 year later, someone tied it. It's 111 miles an hour. So prior to that, it was just over 100. So that's a big jump at a professional level in any sport. Year later, someone tied it. Year after that, someone tied it. Year after that, people just started beating it regularly. Now it's up to 119, and there's high schoolers shooting 111 miles an hour. So the long story short is that as Roger Bannister passed the baton off to the next slate of runners, you know, what I think we should all be doing in my version of it is give a stick to another person, try to grow the game 1 mile an hour at a time. And then personally, my goals are to kind of chase humanity and human interests and tell those stories and provide amplified platforms for other people.
That's awesome. Well, I truly enjoy the consistent, everyday, persistent, never quit enjoyment of watching you pursue your potential. And to have you as my new friend, I know it's been a year long, a couple conversations, but I know we're vibrating at the same level. It's been a pleasure to have you here. Let's hear it for Paul Rabil.
Thanks. Thank you.
We are Entrepreneur The Playbook Live. Thank you.
Thanks.
Be sure to tune in next Tuesday when we feature another story on how a sports icon went from the playing field to the boardroom.